I'm Nish Wyseth.
I'm Amy Sullivan, and this is Impolite Company, a show where we talk about the tricky subjects polite people are supposed to avoid, especially religion and politics.
This week, we're bringing you two quick updates on stories from last week about the selection of a new president and prophet for the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and the fallout from revelations that a popular megachurch pastor sexually abused a teenager while he was her youth pastor.
We'll also talk about the budget showdown happening in Congress right now, with the two issues at the forefront of the standoff: the status of both DACA recipients and the Children's Health Insurance Program, also known as CHIP. Both issues are important to a majority of religious groups around the country.
And that will bring us to our deep dive for this week: President Trump's now infamous comments denigrating the citizens of Haiti and El Salvador, describing countries in Africa as, quote, shithole countries, and perhaps most damningly, insisting that the U.S. should instead admit more immigrants from countries like Norway. And we'll discuss the response to these remarks from independent evangelical leaders and evangelical institutions alike.
Last week, we discussed the death of President Thomas S. Monson, the former prophet and leader of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, commonly known as the Mormon Church. On Tuesday morning, during a televised news conference and address, the leadership of the church announced that Russell Nelson will succeed Monson as the new president of the church. He also selected his two counselors, Dallin Oaks and Henry Eyring.
To the Mormon faithful, this will likely come as no surprise. The president of the church is always the most senior serving member of the leadership, so the selection of Nelson was totally expected. There also wasn't a lot of surprise when he selected his counselors to make up the new first presidency of the church, or the highest governing group in church leadership. Dallin H. Oaks was the next most senior serving member and a close friend to President Nelson. And it's common for a member of the previous first presidency to stay on with the newly formed top leadership, so Henry B. Eyring really wasn't a surprise either. And there's a lot to learn about President Nelson that I learned recently. He is a world-renowned heart surgeon, performed many groundbreaking surgeries that, you know, he has saved thousands of lives. He speaks five different languages. He plays the piano and has perfect pitch. He has like 116 great grandchildren.
Yikes.
And he's like, I know all of their names. I'm like, how is that possible? I have no idea how that's possible. Anyway, really fascinating guy. He's also 93 years old. And his first counselor that he selected, so the president will select two counselors, the first and second counselor. His first counselor that he selected is a man named Dallin H. Oaks. He's a former lawyer and a former Utah State Supreme Court justice. And he was actually considered for the U.S. Supreme Court back during, I think, Reagan. He is incredibly conservative. Incredibly conservative. A lot of people think that he kind of has like a hardliner stance. And so his selection made a lot of more liberal Mormons pretty uneasy today when that news came out. And then there's Henry B. Eyring, who served as the first counselor for the former president, Thomas S. Monson. And he is also older. He's 85 now, I think. Dallin Oaks is 83. President Nelson's 93. So three much older gentlemen. Henry Eyring is kind of seen as more of like middle of the road, very tenderhearted in his addresses. The guy, I have watched him speak multiple times, and he is, it's so dear. He can never get through a talk without crying. It's so darling. Just very sweet man. So it makes up a really interesting dynamic in the Mormon church. A lot of people are concerned, especially on the more liberal side, that the selection of now President Oaks will push the church to a more conservative place at a time when the cultural influence around some of these big social issues is moving further and further left, which would alienate church members even more. So there's definitely some concern there. But a lot of people are confident that kind of the mantle of the position that Elder Oaks, who's the first counselor now holds, will maybe soften him a little bit. So we'll see. We'll see what happens. But it is a very, very interesting time. And then the next general conference of the church, which is when all of the leaders of the church get up and speak and they give their addresses, which kind of dictates what the Mormon faithful will be studying and talking about over the course of the next 6 months. That happens in April. That will be kind of our first real indication to who, I mean, most importantly, who President Nelson will be acting as the prophet of the church, and to see, you know, what issues will start to define his ministry. For Thomas S. Monson, we talked last week with Anthony Sweat, and he was very much defined by, you know, the care and love of the poor and the widow and the orphan. And so I'm really interested to see what direction President Nelson will take, but also what type of impact the first presidency as a whole will have on the ministry of the church and how it will react and how it will interact with issues that are happening in our culture at large. And I'm also interested to see, now there are two vacancies in the next most senior governing body of the church and the quorum of the 12 apostles. And there's a possibility that a person of color could be selected in that position for the first time, which could be really cool. So we'll see. It's all kind of up in the air. But yeah, very, very interesting, but not surprising in all of the selections that happened this morning.
So Nish, is there any reason to think that the selection of priorities for the church, which, as you say, is kind of slated to be indicated at the general conference, is there any reason to think that that would have a bearing on the Senate race if, say, Mitt Romney gets in? Or is within Utah his Mormonism not really an issue, except that it is in asset?
Oh, I mean, Mitt Romney. I mean, let's just go ahead and say this out loud. Mitt Romney's going to run. Mark my words. The man is running for Senate. If he doesn't, I will eat my shoe. Like, the man's going to run. But, you know, I really think he's going to run. So his Mormon faith here in Utah, and particularly because he's also a Republican, is nothing but an asset. It's kind of the reality of living here. It's very hard, actually, to get elected to public office of any kind or to hold any sort of leadership in the state if you're not Mormon. It's just the dynamic of the state that we live in. Here in Salt Lake proper, it's just under 50% Mormon in the city, which is still a pretty large number of people who are LDS. But as soon as you jump out of Salt Lake proper, that number skyrockets, you know, up into the 70s, 80s, and then down in like Utah County, you're looking at upwards of 98% of the people being LDS. So we'll see. I mean, the interesting thing is that just like in kind of any religious body or any religious faith tradition, there are variances, right? There are different, there's like a spectrum of belief. And so there are people who are Democrat who are Mormon. There are people who are very moderate who are Mormon, who didn't vote for a guy like Mike Lee, who was very, you know, Tea Party, far right wing conservative Republican, is also the other senator from Utah. And there are a lot of Mormons that don't agree with him on his politics at all. And so it'll be really interesting to see how it plays out. But as far as Mitt Romney's Mormon faith, yeah, it's going to be nothing but an asset. I mean, the last time he ran for president against Barack Obama and lost, he won Utah. It was like in the 70s, like 72%, I think, maybe. I'll have to look it up. But I'm pretty sure he won by a large margin. And that was at the height of, you know, the Mormon moment. And yeah, it was only an asset here. So yeah, we'll see how that plays out.
We also wanted to point you to a few new developments in the Andy Savage story that we discussed last week. First, Savage announced late last week that he's taken a leave of absence from his church while the situation is investigated. This announcement came during an appearance he made on a Friends radio talk show, during which the two men spent much of their time implying that the victim is unchristian because she didn't particularly want to dialogue with Savage now about the assault. That's an implication. They didn't say unchristian, but if you have been around these stories, if you've been in a church that has had to deal with something like this, you know the language of, you know, it's your responsibility as a good Christian to sit down with your brother and sister and talk through these things. Go on a journey with us.
Never mind that they're abusive.
Work it out. Ugh. Exactly. It's something that we've heard in far too many cases, and it's always unfair. It's always adding another burden to the shoulders of victims. But what really gets me is, in this case, it's particularly disingenuous, because the woman who has spoken out says she did so only after she emailed Savage and said, hey, remember what happened? I'd like to talk about it. And he blew her off. He ignored the email. So he had a chance to dialogue. It just wasn't until he was called out publicly that he decided, maybe it would be a good idea to call out this woman and ask her why she's not willing to sit down with me on my friend's talk show.
Right.
And talk to the two of us in a totally neutral environment.
And try to flip the script and shift the blame. Barf.
Exactly. Yeah. But there are a few bright spots to this story in terms of the discussions it's inspiring about how churches should and should not respond to revelations of abuse. Ed Stetzer, a leading evangelical figure who runs the Billy Graham Center at Wheaton, and who's my candidate to replace Russell Moore as white conservative evangelical man who is making sense, although I probably need to come up with a less wordy title for that, has a terrific column on Christianity Today's site that I highly recommend. We will link to that on Twitter and on our Facebook posts, and I suggest you all take a look at it. For now, I'll just quote a few bits from it. And I should also say it's kind of ridiculous that it should be so noteworthy that a male leader in white conservative evangelical circles is concerned about how churches treat victims, but it is. So I want to share these words from Ed's column, because this is somebody who's using his platform to preach hard truths. The standing ovation, Ed writes, and he's referring to the reaction of High Point Church that we discussed last week, quote, was a terrible idea that served to accomplish nothing but to teach victims that they won't be heard, unquote. And as for Andy, referring to the abuse as simply an incident, as he did on the radio program, and his colleagues at High Point have used that term as well. Well, Ed brings some fire. Listen to this. Quote, a youth pastor does not have incidents with youth group members. He abuses them. On this point, the church needs to speak with absolute clarity. Instances such as this are not an incident. It's abuse. Amen. And thank you, Ed.
Yeah. And to acknowledge that, like, there is an inherent problem when someone abuses that power dynamic in such a way. Like, how refreshing. I mean, I hate it. Like, I hate that we have to have this conversation. Obviously, it's horrific for this woman who suffered this abuse. But at the same time, I'm like, how nice to finally hear someone call it for what it is, that it's abuse and that it is a horrible, horrible exploitation of a power dynamic. And it feels good to hear someone say that, especially a conservative white evangelical man, to come alongside and say, like, no, this is abuse. This is wrong. And the response of this church was wrong, was really heartening as a woman, I have to say. I don't know about you, but it was nice, frankly.
Well, we'd like to see more of that.
Yes, wouldn't we all? Be great.
So our next topic, having given you these updates, is the budget showdown currently happening in the halls of Congress as we speak. The House and Senate need to pass a spending bill that will fund the government, and the deadline is January 19th, this Friday. But in order to fund the government, they'll need a few Democratic votes, and Democrats are demanding action on two key items. The first is protection for Dreamers. That's the term you may all know that describes recipients of the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA. These are individuals who arrived to the United States as children when their parents immigrated into the country illegally. And for all intents and purposes, they are Americans. But while Trump and other Republicans have promised a solution that will allow Dreamers to stay in the country legally, they have shown no urgency at all to produce or agree to one.
And the second issue that the Democrats are bringing to the floor, which they finally have the power to do, like what you were saying, because to pass the spending bill, I believe they can't pass by a simple majority. I think it has to be
60.
The 60 votes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the second issue that they're demanding action on, which I am very passionate about, is the Children's Health Insurance Program, or CHIP for short. And this is the government-funded healthcare plan for children. In families who make too much money to qualify for Medicaid, but they don't make enough money to purchase insurance on the private market. And so this is a group of about 9 million kids total who have insurance and healthcare coverage under CHIP. 9 million children. Okay, children. This should not be controversial. These are children.
It used to not be controversial.
No, that's right. It is a widely beloved program with historically high bipartisan support. The program was originally created by Ted Kennedy and Orrin Hatch, for Pete's sake. But the deadline for funding for CHIP was actually back in September, on September 30th. And there has still been no funding. So this thing is running out of money and fast. And states who receive the money from the government have already started notifying CHIP recipients, these families, that the funding for this will likely go away. States do not have the money to pay for it. And so if the federal government does not step in and allocate adequate funding, children in these states will lose their health care coverage, one of which is here in my home state of Utah. It is completely enraging. And so the deadline for funding was back in September, and there still has been no funding. And this could leave millions of children, both sick and healthy, like kids who are receiving cancer treatments, treatments for diabetes, treatments for the flu, just immunizations, well child checkups, eye exams, dental exams, you name it, healthcare, sick and healthy at risk of losing their health insurance. It is a travesty, and it's unconscionable. And nobody can seem to figure out why Congress would let this go without funding outside of just sheer cruelty, because somehow they managed to find all of this support and all of this willpower to pass this massive tax bill, giving giant tax cuts to people who don't need them, but they can't find the money to fund children's health care. It's disgusting. Makes me mad.
Well, and one of the things you and I have discussed, Nish, is that these two programs are not just, and particularly CHIP has enjoyed really widespread bipartisan support, but DACA to some extent has its supporters on both sides. But they don't just have bipartisan support. It's really unusual to find this kind of widespread religious support.
Yes, across the board.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. It's everybody from the Evangelical Religious Liberty Commission, which put out a statement demanding action on DACA, the U.S. Council for Catholic Bishops, the Faith and Freedom Coalition, Ralph Reed's group. They don't usually stand alone.
Yeah.
Side. More liberal groups like Jewish human rights organizations, the National Hispanic Christian Leadership Conference, Council on American Islamic Relations, National Association of Evangelicals, just to name a few, and all of the religious lefties that you would assume would be behind this too. We name the more conservative groups just because it's so unusual to have everybody at the same table. But they've listed strong support for both DACA and for CHIP because everybody thinks it's a good idea.
Yeah, but that's because it is a good idea. I mean, just to talk about DACA for a second, I heard it explained this way. Dreamers, or these, you know, undocumented immigrants who arrived here as children, this is the only country that they've ever known, like you said. The way to describe dreamers is that they are undocumented Americans. Like, that's what they are. They don't know anything else. This is their country. This is their home. This is where they were raised. This country and this culture, for all of its, you know, glorious things and its faults, raised them. This is home. And that we would punish these people who have been here their whole life, or as long as they can remember, because their parents made a choice, that we would punish them because of their parents' choice, is horrific. And that we would send them back to a country that they have no ties to. Some of them are war-torn. Some of them are really, really dangerous places for them to go. And if we send them back, like, there's a chance, like, we're risking their lives. And that we would consider doing this is so antithetical to everything that, like, pretty much every religious faith group that I know of stands for. I think everyone would say, like, no, these are people that should be protected. We should not be punishing what were children who are now, you know, young adults, some of them. And it's pretty remarkable to watch so many religious institutions come together and say, like, you know, and demand action. Like, this isn't just, you know, they're saying, like, yeah, we support whatever Congress does. Like, there have been long, lengthy statements delivered by some of these organizations. I'm looking here at the one from the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission. For those of you who aren't aware of the ERLC, they're essentially the lobbying arm of the Southern Baptist Convention. So a lot of money, a lot of power, very deeply conservative. And I'm looking here at what's happening and, like, what they're saying. And one of the first things that they say is that we shouldn't punish children for their parents' mistakes. And I think everyone agrees to that. But the underlying thing that I think we forget is that, yes, did their parents immigrate here illegally? Yes. Yes, they did. But they were doing that to, like, seek a better life for their family. Like, there's a reason that people want to come here. And there's a reason that people leave and flee war-torn, you know, ravaged countries by, you know, crime and drugs and, I mean, a whole host of reasons. Economic poverty, you name it. There's a whole host of reasons why people leave. And these families who risked everything to bring their kids here just wanted a better life for their kids. And these kids have enjoyed all of the benefits that they had dreamed for their children. And now they're here and they're, like, tax-paying, contributing members of our, you know, thriving society and our culture. And we would be less, truly, if they left. We wouldn't really truly be who we are as a country and as a culture without the contributions of so many of these young people. And it's such a travesty, and it's such a, I mean, it's so heartbreaking that we would even consider not protecting these people. And so it's my hope, I don't know about you, but it is my hope that Democrats hold the line. I really do. I hope they hold the line and demand action for DACA and for CHIP. I mean, CHIP's an entirely different situation that I could talk about through an entire episode. But both of these things, I think the Democrats should stand their ground, because there's no reason why these two should be some sort of bargaining chip, and that the Republican Party should hold these two things hostage. Like, it's pretty common sense bipartisan support that these two things should be protected and passed and funded. So we'll see. We'll see what happens.
Yeah. You know, I find myself with these issues just having the hardest time even knowing what to say. It's not that I don't think they're both supremely good ideas that should just be acted on and checked off the to-do list. But, man, it's been hard over the past year to just feel beaten down by all of the different fights that people have had to mobilize for. And I can't even imagine, you know, being somebody who is intimately affected by these issues, but also the folks who have been on the front lines fighting the fight, the religious leaders who have been up on the Hill, who have been getting themselves arrested. And it feels like every few weeks there's a new one. And good Lord, I don't know when they're sleeping. I don't know when they're catching up on really any parts of their lives. And, you know, this is not a wildly creative point. It just, I felt like it couldn't pass unmentioned that there is just this fatigue. And it doesn't mean giving up, but I just... I do worry about it because it has a cumulative effect of just making it seem like the hill is very, very tall to be climbed. And you keep getting pushed back down.
And I said this in my piece that I wrote for Cosmopolitan magazine about the children's healthcare program. Yeah, there is advocacy fatigue. there's so much to fight, whether it's DACA, whether it's CHIP. I mean, there's a whole host of, it was healthcare. It was, you know, taxes. It was, I mean, you name it. It just seems like there's always one thing after another to go to bat for, and it gets really exhausting. The thing that keeps me going is knowing that I am in a profound place of privilege, that I am not at the receiving end of some of these horrible policies. Like, I am not a DACA immigrant who is actually like looking down the pike at potential deportation. I don't currently have a child on CHIP that may lose their health care. And so I have a little bit of extra fight in me, right? Because I'm not having to not only worry about my own well-being or the well-being of my child. And so I can step up maybe just a little bit more. And so even though it seems like we are like constantly, every time we turn around, having to fight like policy after shitty policy, and we're all exhausted, and we're always, you know, hounding our senators and congress people about something new. But if it gives you just a little bit more motivation this week as you, you know, are engaging in some of these issues in your communities, or even if you're just listening to the pod right now and wondering, how can I help? And it may motivate you just a little bit just to pick up the phone, call your congressman or your senator in their office, send a fax, send an email, send a text, like whatever it takes. Just do that one extra little thing, because right now there are millions of children and their families who need us, and they need people to stand in the gap. Like, there are families who are sitting in hospitals with kids who are fighting cancer and fighting for their lives that have children's health care through CHIP. And if this goes away, and if CHIP doesn't get funded, it's like the equivalent of someone walking into their hospital room and like unplugging all the machines and asking them to leave, because the other option is that it bankrupts them. It can bankrupt a family. And so the reality is so dire. And sometimes it's easy to lose sight of the fact that there are real people and real children, like real young people, that are facing deportation, being forced back to a country they've never been to, that they may not even have family in anymore. And that there's kids being treated for illnesses all across this country that may lose their health care and may not be able to afford those treatments anymore. So if there's anything that can help motivate us, let's just keep in mind that for too many kids, for way too many kids in this country, this is an actual life or death situation. And if you have a little bit of fight in you, now is the time. So start calling your representatives in the House and the Senate on behalf of these kids who like really so desperately need this legislation and this funding, and ask our representatives to fully fund CHIP and to protect the Dreamers. We can all take 5 minutes at the end of the day, even if you just leave a voicemail. It's worth it. Let those senators and those congresspeople hear their phones ringing off the hook, because it works. It really does work. Your voices are heard, and I think sometimes we lose sight of that. So let that be my little pep talk and encouragement to all of you out there who are like, I can't do it. I can't call one more time. Yes, you can. Pick up the phone. Call your congressperson. You can do it. I promise. Well, that brings us to our main topic this week. President Trump's racist comments in the context of immigration, complaining, quote, "Why do we need more Haitians? Take them out," unquote, and referring repeatedly to countries in Africa as, quote, pardon my language, shithole countries, unquote. Not only that, he suggested that we shouldn't allow people from these countries to immigrate to the U.S., but should allow people from countries like Norway instead. yes, let's keep out all of the people of color and only let out and only let in the white blonde people. I'll be honest and say that while the language wasn't something I was necessarily expecting, it's always a bit jarring to hear cussing come out of the mouth of the leader of the free world rather than from my own mouth, which happens often. The content of what he was saying wasn't surprising to me at all. And a lot of what he insinuated only further solidified what so many people have known for a long time and what so many people of color have been sounding the alarm on since well before the election, that the president of the United States is racist and xenophobic.
What was surprising this week and somewhat heartening was the swift response from many evangelicals, both individual leaders and institutions, which issued strong statements on social media condemning Trump's statements. And also, as many of you may have heard, at least I hope you did, in your pews on Sunday, there were pastors around the country who were speaking out as well. But I'm not going to let us move on to the positive part of this and the response too fast, because I got to call out folks like Robert Jeffress. And I know we've mentioned him a lot, but you know what? The guy
is the worst.
The guy is he's at the White House a lot. So it's hard to ignore him. He called up David Brody from Christian Broadcasting Network and said, not basically, he said, you know, those aren't language words that I would use, apart from the vocabulary attributed to him. President Trump is right on target in his sentiment, which our friend Rachel Held Evans, I think appropriately summed up as, so saying shit isn't okay, but being a racist is.
Exactly.
And it is basically the response of a lot of folks in the core evangelical world. Johnny Moore was another who was like, well, I don't really approve of that language. There aren't a lot of us who use those words, but you know, I think he's pretty much saying what the rest of us think and agree with.
Nope.
Which,
nope. Sure don't. Sure don't agree with it. That's what I have to say. And it's so frustrating to see these guys get so worked up about, like, the term shithole. Like, don't get me wrong. I mean,
oh, but they're not worked up. They needed something to be able to just flick at as, well, of course we don't condemn him swearing. But they also use that to try to turn it around and say, you know, anybody who has a problem with this is just being, you know, a Victorian era prude who is like on the fainting couch because the president said something tough. That being the euphemism of this week, the tough language that he used. Nobody is upset about the fact that he swore. They're upset about the sentiment behind that and the fact that he is just openly saying, I don't want people from brown countries in here, and I do want white people here. It does not get much more racist than that. Even if you say, I am not a racist, at the point you have to say, I am not a racist, you are a racist.
Yep. There was a woman on Twitter named Caitlin, I think Scheiss is her last name. She said, this is how we know it's idolatry. Evangelical leaders keep defending a man who devalues, disregards, and dehumanizes the people they claim to love through missions. We'll send our teenagers to get selfies with black and brown children, but we won't defend their humanity. That just about put me on the floor, because I cannot think of a more astute response to so much of what evangelicals, these particular evangelical leaders who, for what ever god-awful reason, continue to support this guy, have been saying. And it's so frustrating. Like, it just goes to show, like, here's another example. This guy can brag about sexual assault. This guy could say there are both, like, you know, there are good people on both sides when we're talking about the KKK or, you know, like neo-Nazi groups in Charlottesville. There is literally nothing that could make these evangelical leaders who have access to the White House turn their back on this guy. When Trump said during the election that he could go out on like Fifth Avenue and shoot someone and people would still vote for him, I actually think he's right, particularly about these like evangelical leaders that just will not, like, there's literally no line. There's just no line. And there's no line that he could cross that would make them turn their back. And it is such a disgusting addiction and display of a like gripping of power. Like, they just want to be close to power. That's really what it is. And it's gross. It's so gross. But thankfully, they are not the only ones who have a voice. There have been a lot of people who have come out and said some things against it, especially some like conservative evangelicals have come out pretty strongly. I know you had some things that you had your eye on.
It's true. Before I get to that, though, I want us to talk about something that's maybe a little more sensitive, because I was not much more comfortable with the responses I started to see coming from folks who said, you know, of course, you know, we can't support what Trump says. We have, you know, so many wonderful brothers and sisters in Christ who we work with on the missions in these countries when we go. And, you know, I will stipulate there are people doing good work in lots of places around the world who are motivated by their Christian beliefs. There are also, though, we have to talk about folks who, while they wouldn't put it this way, are motivated to go to countries in Africa because they feel so bad for the people who have to live in what they essentially think of as shithole circumstances and who need their help. Don't just need to be saved, of course, but who really, you know, wouldn't have a chance of making it through life without white saviors coming in and fixing everything. Never mind that all sorts of problems that are very real around the world are in many ways caused by our policies and our hoarding of resources and our refusal for years to work with the kinds of leaders who could have brought more power down to the grassroots level and empowered people instead of encouraging us to just provide the leadership with money and resources that it promised it would distribute. I mean, I have a problem with the mindset that isn't too many steps removed from Trump's, even though it's well-intentioned instead of being malicious. I think we need to acknowledge that whether it comes out of love or hate, thinking of folks in these other countries as, oh, people who are poor and unfortunate, it is just a problem.
Yeah, it's, I mean, to put it bluntly, yeah, it's a white savior complex and colonialism. It's really what it is.
And it is racist.
It is super racist.
It's in another, you know, costume, but it is racist.
Yes, it is super, super racist. Really, I mean, just it. I can't even like call it misguided, right? Like it's just, it's so deeply entrenched with really terrible theology about like this kind of like intertwining of, you know, God's favor with American exceptionalism and, you know, all of these things. It's just, it's enraging, number one, but we have to start waking up to how much damage this is doing around the world. And the president's comments are just one, like, small indicator of just how, like, sick our minds are and how much we don't understand the cultures of other places. And I mean, frankly, just that other people from other countries are human, right? That they are not less than, that we are not better than, that we, like, there's just the sickness of nationalism and American exceptionalism that is plaguing us and is plaguing our politics and how we interact in the world. And it has infected our churches too. And watching these guys come out and defend and say, like, well, I definitely agree with the sentiment, is just an indication of that. And it's really, really gross and really damaging and kind of scary, frankly, I think.
Yeah. Which is why, as you tried to get me to move into a little while ago,
segue into some sort of positivity,
which is why it is a nice, and I'll say surprise. It's a nice surprise to see a place like Calvin College, which is not a fundamentalist bastion, but it's not exactly liberal, and Calvin Theological Seminary. The presidents of both those institutions over the weekend put out a statement. And it was a remarkable statement. Like, I think folks from the outside will look at it and be like, yeah, well, duh, of course, you're going to try to distance yourself from Trump and his remarks. And as I've been seeing all over Twitter today, there are a lot of still very angry liberals saying, yeah, well, too bad you voted for him. You don't get to turn around and act surprised at who this guy is. But they put out a statement saying, in part, it is our Christian duty and responsibility to separate ourselves from racist and hateful remarks and sentiments. The world cannot be confused about what we believe. And then I want to read just another passage, too, because I'll underscore after this how extraordinary it is to see these two institutions put out a statement about this, like this, about any president, Democrat or Republican, any politician, really. They say, this love for our brothers and sisters, that it is for this reason, this love for our brothers and sisters, that we are deeply troubled and offended by the disparaging comments attributed to the President of the United States in recent days about people who come from Africa, Haiti, and Latin America. These comments sow fear and hatred in our country, and they are wrong.
Mm-hmm. Amen.
Amen. And yet, you know, I was kind of shocked when I saw that come over my Facebook feed, because I guess I had gotten past the point where I thought even really thoughtful evangelical institutions would feel like they had the freedom to just call out the president like that. I thought we were going to be limited to freaking Marco Rubio's subtweets with Bible verses. And I swear to you, Nish, if he does another one of these, I just want to, like, firebomb his Twitter feed. I cannot take it anymore. There must be a Bible verse about how there takes no courage to subtweet somebody.
I'm just saying that I have I have stepped out in leadership on this issue, Amy, and I have quit Twitter.
I know.
For those who aren't aware, I quit Twitter. I actually deactivated my account, which is an entirely different conversation for another day about the role of social media in our politics. But even when I was on Twitter, every time I saw Marco Rubio's tweets, I was like, oh, please. Like, I think I literally said it out loud every single time I read one of his Bible verse things, which, don't get me wrong, like, not necessarily opposed to someone like, tweeting Bible verses. Like, I think that's good. But Marco Rubio is so disingenuous. Like, the dude has no spine. I'm like, you wouldn't stand on a biblical principle if your life depended on it. Clearly. He's, oh my gosh, that guy.
Well, and that's the thing. I would rather that he was doing, like, some mean girl, passive aggressive tweeting and not, like, hiding behind a Bible verse, as in, like, oh, Donald Trump, the Bible has something to say about that. You should be careful.
Like Donald Trump cares about what the Bible says.
Well, it's all for Marco Rubio, but...
Ugh. Right, of course. Yeah, super annoying, super frustrating. So annoying. The one thing that, like, and I am kind of the mind of the more, like, you know, Christian left on this of, like, okay, well, I mean, I'm glad these institutions and these people are finally saying something. It's better to say the right thing late than not say it at all, I suppose. However, I'm very much like, where have you been? Like, there have been so many instances for the last 2 years, 2+ years since that tyrant strolled and stood there like an idiot coming down his escalator in Trump Tower to announce his, you know, running for president. From that point, I mean, even before then, but from the time he announced his candidacy for president to now, I literally cannot count. I can't recall all of them. All of the opportunities for these sort of evangelical institutions and these evangelical leaders to come out and say something. And it's always like in like both really frustrating, but also really puzzling to me. Like, I'm trying to figure out, like, what was it this time? Like, what was the thing that made you finally change or say something? Like, what's the thing?
I think that's the wrong way to think about it. I don't think that they were fine with everything else and this was just the straw that broke their back. I think that, well, first of all, there are a lot of evangelicals who I think they made the wrong decision, but they just felt they could not vote for Hillary Clinton.
Totally true.
And so, whatever. But that was more than a year ago, so let's set that aside.
Never.
She hasn't been on the stage. That you made your choice, and then he was in office. And on day one, I think that's when your responsibility was to speak up. But they have not. I do think there's been a lot of stomach churning and a lot of hand-wringing among a fair number of thoughtful evangelicals who voted for Trump but really hate everything he stands for. But, again, I've never seen a statement like this come from a Calvin or a Fuller or, you know, Azusa Pacific put out a statement over the weekend. You know, this is something different. The cynical part of me says he just laid it completely bare. Everybody who was saying, you know, I don't want to judge his heart. I'm going to assume like everybody has a chance to change. Like, this made very clear. No, he is an unreconstructed racist and he is not changing. So if that was your statement that you were putting out for everybody as kind of a placeholder, not effective anymore. So he kind of called you out and you had to say something this time. But I think for a lot of folks, it really was just the like slap across the face of this is not a character he plays. This is the just cruel, awful, ignorant person that he is. And enough is enough. You know, it's time for the kind of action and putting out a social media statement is the smallest kind of action that you can take. But I'll take the first action that has to be done. The kind that, you know, has never gone out in opposition to any president, any politician. And, you know, he is a politician like we have never seen before. So, you know, I'll give you a high five for this one. The next one better be bigger and better have more of an impact.
Yeah. I think, I mean, for me, one of the things that I mean, I'm not to, you know, make this any less of a big deal than it is, because the fact that he said this is, I mean, obviously inherently racist, xenophobic, terrible, horrible thing to say, lays bare, all of the things that you said, 100% true. One of the instances for me where I wish there would have been a stronger institutional response was Charlottesville. The silence from Christian institutions around what happened in Charlottesville, where, let's remember, someone died. Like, someone died. And around his comments that there are, you know, well, there's good people on both sides when one side is neo-Nazis. That silence was deafening. And so that, like, that's kind of what I'm talking about. I'm like, we had, like, I felt like his unrepentant and blatant racism had been laid bare. I mean, for me, it was obvious a long time ago, well before the election. But at the very least, like, Charlottesville made it pretty freaking obvious. And yet, and I mean, we did hear a lot of independent or individual evangelical leaders come out and denounce his statements and say that they were racist and all of that. Like, I don't want to negate the fact that many individuals did come out and say that. But I guess from an institutional standpoint, like, what was it about this? Is it because that we had, like, that they have, you know, students or, you know, people who are paying tuition who are from these countries that he called shithole countries? Like, what was it? What was it about this that Charlottesville wasn't, or was, were we still in kind of a precarious situation back in Charlottesville where we were trying to figure out, like, who he was, even though it was pretty obvious? I guess this is just the thing for me. Like, there have been times where, like, since he took office, setting aside the election, but just from the point he took office, where institutions could have come out and said something and they didn't. And I think that's what I was trying to get at when I say, like, what was it about this that made them finally come out and say it? But at the same time, I will cede. I will concede the point and say, better late than never. And I totally agree with you that, like, okay, you said something now. We know that it's going to come again, because this is obviously at the core of who he is, as we've seen from Charlottesville and from his, like, shithole country statements. Like, if this really is kind of at the core of who he is, which people have been saying, you know, is the truth for a long time, it's going to come out again. And so what's your statement going to be next time? And I totally agree with you that it should be stronger and even more emphatic. And so we'll see. I mean, I hope that actually there isn't another reason to put out a statement. That would be the ideal situation, but
that would be another world.
That, yeah, we would be living on a different planet, and that is, you know, not reality. So here we are. So I'm interested to see how it plays out and if any of these institutions, frankly, face some backlash. I mean, looking at some of the Facebook comments on, like, Calvin College's post and their statement, like, there were a lot of, they're getting some pushback. And so I'm curious to see how, if that maybe tempers any sort of future responses, if they get any sort of significant pushback from alumni or, you know, funding and all that kind of stuff.
I'd love to know what kind of conversations they've had from DeVos family.
Betsy
members.
DeVos. That's exactly, yes. Right. I was like, ooh, I wonder what Betsy DeVos thinks of that. Interesting.
Well, we are out of time today. And to wrap up the show, every week we like to leave you with a recommendation, a TV show, maybe a movie, maybe some music. Nish, what do you have for us this week?
Okay, so mine this week is actually, I am going to plug another podcast.
All right.
I mean, it's, that's fair. He does not need my promotion at all, but it is the Ezra Klein Show. So from Vox Media.
Nish.
Okay, no, listen, I'm not plugging just his podcast, just this episode, just this one episode. Okay. Just hold your tongue for a second. Okay.
You're on thin ice, counselor.
Oh,
proceed.
My gosh. Don't be dramatic. Okay. So.
He was my intern. Did you know he was my intern?
What?
He was my intern. Go ahead.
No. Really?
Go ahead.
Where? No, where? At the.
Nope.
Oh, well, now I really
We will take
know.
This offline.
Okay. So, Ezra Klein has an interview. It's his most recent podcast interview from Sunday. And the episode is actually titled, "You Will Love This Conversation with Jaron Lanier, But I Can't Describe It." That's the title of the episode. And I have to tell you, I really did love the conversation, because the guy that he interviews is so unbelievably fascinating. He is what people call a digital philosopher. So he actually studies kind of like the philosophy of the digital age and what technology is doing to society and culture and like all these sorts of things. And so Ezra has this great interview with this guy that is so illuminating and opened my eyes to so many different things about the impact of social media and how social media kind of forces us into more of a pack mentality rather than, you know, independent, like individual thinking, which creates some really unhealthy dynamics, which we see with like bullying and shaming and actually creates counter movements to things that should inherently be positive, but end up turning out to be really negative. So he uses a couple of examples, one of them being the Arab Spring and like the offset or like what happened after kind of the social media movement of the Arab Spring was that social media was used as like a recruiting tool for terrorist organizations and that sort of thing. And then he uses the Black Lives Matter movement, which then the counter to that was kind of this like neo-fascist movement on Twitter and Facebook. And so he kind of breaks down a lot of the problems of the dynamics of social media and technology and what it's doing to our culture and what it's doing to our narratives and doing to the conversations that we need to have. And I mean, that was just a short like part of the interview. I mean, it's like an hour and I can't remember how long. Let me look. I think it's like an hour and 30 minutes or something. It's a long podcast episode, but it is worth every single minute.
I cannot deal with that much extra.
It is. It's like an hour and a half. But the guy that he interviews, like, here's the thing. It doesn't feel long because the guy that he interviews is so like fascinating and also really, really funny. He has this laugh, like every time he laughs about something, it made me giggle because it was so like infectious and joyful. It just exuded out from the speakers. It was so great. And so you want to listen to him because he's just this amazing communicator talking about really significant issues that are affecting our culture and, you know, sort of the moments that we're experiencing as a country and our politics. And it's such a great interview. And despite what you think about Ezra Klein, Amy, you should listen to it for this other guy. And because it is worth it. It's fantastic. It'll start wonderful conversations. I've already been having several conversations about it today with different people who have listened to it. And it's just so, so good. And also hat tip to my friend Nate Pyle, who alerted me to the podcast episode and told me, he was like, you have to listen to this after we were kind of talking about me quitting Twitter. And so he was like, you got to listen to this. And so super good. That is my recommendation. I'm sorry that you didn't like it.
My choice is, we're not even going to engage. My choice is another British television show.
Surprise, surprise.
I may have mentioned before that I enjoy Broadchurch very much.
No, you didn't tell me that. Did you?
Oh, yes. Yes.
Oh, I like Broadchurch.
Yes, I thought the first season was fantastic. The second season, not in love with. Third season, really quite good, I have to say. My only criticism would be, and I have the same criticism of all the shows that are supposed to feature incredibly intelligent, instinctive detectives who yet somehow have to keep following red herrings so that they don't discover who did it until the end of the 8 episodes. I find that part of thrillers and mysteries very annoying. But what really just delivers the joy for me in Broadchurch, and this was the final season, the third and final season, I think that's a good choice on their part because I hate it when shows do not just wrap up when they should.
Well, doesn't isn't one of the stars now the new doctor? Oh.
Yes.
Sorry.
But
I thought that was common knowledge.
It is. One of the other stars is going to be, at least I think this is confirmed, Queen Elizabeth in the next
yes
season of The Crown. So Olivia Colman. But then a former Doctor Who, David Tennant, is the other detective. And they make just the most wonderful duo. You would think that the like grumpy detective paired with the like kind of peppy detective would be played out at this point. But it is just so wonderful. He has this thick Scottish accent and he's always calling Milla at her. And it's, I love it so much.
Yeah, he's darling.
It was just wonderful to hang out with the two of them for 8 more episodes. And now it's gone. Gone from my life.
Well, but at least it's like, you know, not like committing to Game of Thrones or something where you have like 7 plus seasons of, you know, super intense, you know, character development and all these different storylines. Like Broadchurch, the 3 seasons feels like, okay, I can commit to that. People can and like yet, sit down, plow through the whole season and it's doable, right?
You know, Game of Thrones is not coming back till 2019.
I don't even want to talk about it. I'm so mad about it. Especially since like all of these other shows that I love aren't coming back until like late 2018, 2019. I'm like, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? It's so long. Can't believe I have to wait this long.
There's time for you to catch up with the Americans.
That's true. And so many other shows. But I'm ready. It better be good. That's what I have to say. Last season of Game of Thrones better be epic. If it's not, I'm going to be pissed.
He's still writing it.
Yeah, that's true. They're still writing it. And I don't know. We'll see. We'll see what happens. But, okay. So Broadchurch. Last season of Broadchurch. Good to know. On Netflix. All right. Well, that is all for this week's episode. Thank you for joining us. Impolite Company is produced every week by Constantine Hios. If you've enjoyed our conversation, please, please, please rate us on iTunes. It is the very best way to let other people know about us and to expand these conversations. And as always, we will post the show notes on our Facebook page, Impolite Company, the podcast. And until next week, have fun storming the castle, kids.